The topics discussed here tonight are general in nature, and you should seek personal advice before acting on any of this information. And now, on 2GB 873, The Bottom Line. Thanks to IT Financial Services, high-quality financial planning. Visit itfs.com.au.
Indeed, very high quality, and joining us, the highest of quality from IT this evening, Carly Tonkinson and Philip Tafe. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Thanks for that intro.
That's all right. It's all downhill from here. Now, only joking. Plenty to get through tonight, and if anyone has any questions, of course, they can call the open line. 131-873 is the open line number. Any questions about what, I suppose, their personal finance, their questions might be about superannuation.
Yeah, investments.
Could have come into a windfall and want to know how to best invest it.
Yeah, anything.
Those lucky people. 131-873, of course, is the number. The team from IT Financial Services here for the next, 52 minutes or so. 131-873. Let's kick off talking about retirement. When is the best time to retire?
When you've got enough money is probably the obvious one. But traditionally, a lot of people still think waiting till the end of a financial year is a good way to go. Generally, look, if you're expecting a big termination payment, so if you've been with the same employer for a long time and you're thinking you might get a long service leave, an annual leave and that sort of thing paid out, it can be a good idea to delay retirement until July, so the new financial year.
Mm-hmm.
Also, if you're over 65 and you're wanting to make contributions to super in the future, working even just a month into the new financial year means you've got a whole extra year to contribute to super, whereas otherwise you wouldn't have been able to, due to the fact that once you're over 65, you do need to meet a work test. So if you haven't been employed in the financial year, you can't contribute to super anymore over the age of 65.
Mm.
So in those two examples, just working a few extra weeks even can save you either a lot of tax or give you the ability to get a lot more money into superannuation.
It also depends on how you're planning to retire. Sometimes it's because of redundancy. You know, it's forced upon you rather than
being a
choice. And there are different tax rates that apply if you're leaving a job because you're being made redundant as opposed to retiring. And that can actually change your decision on whether you should be retiring, I guess, before the end of June or pushing it into July the following year. So, yeah, very much up to individual circumstance. But a thing we often look at is, I guess, what other plans you have around retirement, because often people are then looking to maybe sell an investment property or something like that to help fund their retirement. And like Carly mentioned, you might want to be doing that in an income year or a year in which your income is low. And so you might be looking to just work for a small period of time, in July to then enable you to use the proceeds from that sale to get it into super and, I guess, set yourself up more tax effectively.
Just a quick question then for the uninitiated. You mentioned there if you had an investment property, you may wish to sell that in a year where your income was low. Why would that be?
So that comes down to capital gains tax. So the way the system works is when you sell an asset for a profit, let's assume you've held that property for more than a year, they'll have a look at whatever gain that you've made. So let's say you've made $100,000 on that property. They'll halve it, and that $50,000 would then get added to your income for the year and taxed as if it was just normal income. So if you've earned nothing else that financial year, there's going to be very little tax to pay. Whereas if you've worked for a full year and earned $50,000 or $100,000 salary, it's going to push you into a much higher tax bracket and you pay more capital gains tax.
Yeah, so if you earn $0 in next year and you sell your investment property, you would sell an investment property, and say that capital gains tax component is $50,000, are you only paying tax on what is above the tax-free threshold, which is, what, $32,500 as it is now or something? So you're only paying tax on that $20,000 left at the top.
Yeah, it's just taxed as normal income. So there's no actual capital gains tax, as it were. It's just how much is included as assessable income.
Mm. Okay. Interesting. 131873, talking about these sort of factors. Greg's on the phone. G'day, Greg.
Hey, going? Sorry, I just started a printer. Let me turn that off.
That's okay. We can't hear that. What's your question?
I've just been made redundant, and it's a reasonable payout, and I have an investment property. And I seem to be burning through this money very quickly because I've got no income at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to pay the investment property. I'm trying to live. And work hasn't really given me any paperwork. I don't know what's the best thing to do with the money. And
right. Have you already received your redundancy payout?
Yes, I have.
Okay. So what paperwork are you still waiting on, Greg?
Any of it. I haven't seen any of it yet.
Right. Okay. Is that in relation to your redundancy payment?
Yes, and I don't know how they divide up the tax. I don't know whether the tax was paid properly on it or...
All right. Well, yeah, I mean, certainly, standard is that you would receive that before the payment so that you can look over the numbers, but hopefully you will receive that through soon. How old are you, Greg?
51.
Okay. So as you're under superannuation preservation age, you're fairly limited in what you can do as far as your super goes.
Right.
So really what you need to look at is, are you looking to get more another job?
Oh, yes. If anybody wants to employ somebody as old as I am, yes.
We hope there's hope some 51-year-olds.
I hope so, yeah. 51, you've got a while to go yet. So realistically, the important thing for you at the moment is to maintain flexibility. So with that payout that you've received, to hold on to that until you do receive further employment, just because you can't access your super, and realistically you are going to need to rely on some of that money to get you through. You've also, even though you've got some waiting periods to serve, there is a potential to look towards like a new start allowance type arrangement with Centrelink.
That's what I need to look at, because I've got some severely serious health issues. I tend to burn through like $500-$600 worth of medication a month.
Yeah, okay. So getting some health benefits. So even things, if you look into something like the low-income healthcare card, something like that could also assist you with all those health expenses. Having a large amount in the bank could reduce benefits, but as I said, I think you are better off steering clear of putting that into super at this stage until you do get further employment, simply because once it goes in, you won't be able to get it back out again.
No, that's fair enough.
And there's very little nowadays with redundancy that you can do to reduce tax. There used to be some benefits to rolling money into super, etc., but those loopholes have been tied up. So.
I'm not trying to cheat anybody or cheat the government or anything. I'm just trying to do the best I can with what I've got to keep myself, without sucking government purse dry a little bit.
Yeah, I think, look, Greg, if you haven't got some advice, at least meet with someone and have an initial chat, because it's really important that that money that you've got there is set up so that it will last and be sufficient for you to get through this time until you do get further employment.
Okay.
All right.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Greg.
Well done, Greg. Thank you for calling. 131873 is the number if you have a question in regard to Greg's situation. What he's 51, but obviously with some physical hardship in far as his health is concerned, as well as obviously a lack of employment. Is there no way that he could start accessing his super?
Super would be pretty tough to access because he would need to be permanently disabled. Not knowing his full health history, it's hard to say, but you do have to be deemed totally and permanently disabled by two medical professionals. Then the trustee has to agree to release the money. It's quite difficult to get. He could also look at potentially disability pension through Centrelink, which previously has always been easier to get than access to your super, but I understand they are making that harder and harder for people to get.
Even the insurance attached to his super as well, potentially. If he was unable to work, and that's what is stopping him getting a new job or something like that, there could be some kind of claim on disability insurance or income protection, I guess.
But as we know, sometimes that can be a little more difficult to access. You've got to read the fine print about that.
Absolutely. And with that total and permanent disability insurance, it depends heavily on what kind of definition that you've got. A lot of these policies are advertised based on price. We're cheap. We're a good super fund. We've got cheap insurance. But that might mean you have much less chance of claiming on that policy. So
with disability, it tends to be that they use like a living definition, which means if you can't, perform two of the five duties of daily living. So virtually if you can't feed yourself or take yourself to the bathroom, that's what's required. A lot of the more comprehensive policies are more about whether or not you can actually perform your job. So,
okay, 131873 is the number. We'll take a break, back with more in just a second. Have your company. It is officially now the 12th of April 2016 in Sydney, and we're talking personal finance in the First hour of the program with the team from IT Financial Services, 131873 if you have a question for either Carly or Philip, and they're here from IT Financial Services. Anything to do with your personal finance, might be a question about your super, what to do with some money you've just come into, something about property perhaps, give us a call, 131873. Talking about property, guys, we're hearing all this talk about high-speed rail now, and of course, you know, there's concern that, in fact, I'll speak to someone later in the show about this, concern that the Sydney property market particularly is now too heavily weighted with new units coming in and there'll be an adverse effect on price. Some of the banks could be exposed. The point, I suppose, of raising it is that we're being told that you can have this funding model where if you build the railway lines out to Goulburn or, in Melbourne's case, up to Shepparton, then beyond later on you can value capture some of the property and real estate. I mean, is it a good time maybe for people who are thinking, look, I think the Sydney market's hit its boiling point, but there's all this talk about rail and everyone keeps saying Goulburn. I mean, is it maybe wise to sniff around down there and see what properties are available as an investor?
Yeah, I get. I mean, it's highly speculative.
Yeah, risk return, isn't
if
it?
If you had done that when they started talking about high-speed rail,
1984,
well, exactly, you may not have got much return. I think the good thing about investing outside Sydney is the rental yields are so attractive. I mean, Sydney's rent yields are actually extremely low. As an income, they don't really make much sense as an investment. But if you look further afield, yes. But then you think, well, it's not just getting that right. So is Goulburn the going to be the hub? Is that the best place to be? But whereabouts in Goulburn is going to be the best place to be? And it's just very speculative.
But I was hearing from an old friend of mine during the week, you know, telling me about his brother who'd done exactly this kind of thing along the Norwest rail link. You know, I guess he took the punt that it would develop out there at some point.
His brother wasn't a local MP at some point, was he?
Wouldn't surprise me. But yeah, you know, they take the risk, they buy up, and I guess what you don't know is what's the holding time going to be before the payoff comes. And I imagine a high-speed rail link, can you imagine?
Decades.
Yeah, potentially. Mm. All the toing and froing, exactly where is it going to go, how close are you going to be to it? So, yeah, lots of risks, but if you get it right, it can absolutely pay off.
I suppose investing, or as some people like to call it, speculating in the property market is a risk, a gamble anywhere. It's like when you go to the casino. I suppose if you go and play the roulette wheel and you put a little chip on every single thing, well, you're going to get a return, and if it's one of the special ones, you get a very good return. But if you play much more selectively, well, you could get a terrific return for your investment, or you could go bust. And it's a bit like that in real estate, isn't it? It's a safer bet buying into Sydney, but there again, you know, if things go the wrong way, you may not get the return you expect.
Yeah, definitely. And there's in the Weekend Fin Review, there was an article about property investment. I think they were talking particularly about Sydney. And really, I mean, a lot of experts are saying capital growth in Sydney, it's not going to go backwards in a lot of areas, but it will slow right up. And as I said, if income's not coming through in Sydney, which you just don't get income, your rental yields are less than 3%. Mm. So probably less than what you'd get in a bank account. If capital growth slows, I think a lot of people are saying around about the 3% over the next few years, your investment's going backwards, particularly if you're borrowing to go in there. So if you buy it at the wrong time, yeah, that's right. But like any investment, if you're willing to hold on to it for a long period of time, 10, 20 years, it should pay off in the long run.
But a property that's not going up in value as an investor, you're still going backwards, because once you factor in that you've had to pay
maintenance and an agent and everything.
Stamp duty might be 5%, and then agent's fees another couple of percent.
Legal fees.
So factor that in. The property's, it has to go up in value just to break even. So if, like in Sydney, there's a prediction that things just stay flat, you're still losing off the back of that.
And, of course, with wages the way they are, I mean, they have been flat by and large for, 2 years or something. There's no sign they're about to rocket up any time soon either. So
yeah, which is a huge problem. And it's why people find it so hard to get into the Sydney market. Yeah. There's just no way you can keep up with it.
Well, it's saving for that deposit. It's not paying off the loan once you've got it. It's usually getting that 20% deposit to avoid the mortgage insurance.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, this is why we're seeing the emergence of things like parents going guarantor just for the deposit. So historically, where parents had to go guarantor for the whole purchase, which had a lot of risks associated with it, a lot of people's parents now can just go guarantor for that 20%. So what people can do is pay their parents back the 20% and remove that guarantor once they've paid it. So that's a way to sort of jumpstart your entry into the property market. Of course, there are risks, but sometimes it does require a bit of creative thinking.
Yeah, the risk is for the parents because, again, I had another client in this week in exactly that scenario, and his parents had offered to go guarantor and at the last minute backed out because once they saw all the paperwork and what they were actually on the line for, they got cold feet. So they ended up structuring it in a different way where it just became a gift, I guess, behind the scenes in terms of the deposit. And so as far as the bank is concerned, there's no additional loan there, but he eventually does have to pay his parents back.
Well, you mentioned that four-letter word, gift. Now, we've spoken about gifts in previous weeks. There was a limit, was there not, on what a gift is in the ATO's eyes?
No, not from the ATO, but so it's Centrelink where the limit is.
Oh, Centrelink.
Is. So if you want to receive a payment from the government in terms of age pension or... I guess, New Start allowance, then, okay, they're going to look at what money have you been given. But if it's just, you know, you want to give your friend some money, you can absolutely do that. It's more, from the tax office point of view, it's a question on if you have all that extra money, how much interest are you earning on it, and then what extra tax do you have to pay? That's the issue. But there's no tax to pay itself on the gift.
So I suppose that's true. I remember now, but I suppose this is an important point to raise in that if you have parents who are part pensioners or something like that, and many parents would now be part pensioners or pensioners with adult children trying to get in the market, and they're going to say, "Well, look, I'll give you 60,000 for the deposit. We've got it in the bank." They've got to be careful in that circumstance, don't they, because of their pension, their Centrelink status and the gift.
At the moment, they're not going to be worse off, so that's the important point. It goes by financial years as well. So if we take an example like that, they could actually give $10,000 now and then another $10,000 in July, and $20,000 is removed from their assets for Centrelink purposes. Where I would caution people, particularly people on part pensions, is remember that the asset tests are being significantly reduced in January. Don't give away money you've got in the bank that you may need come January to replace any lost age pension because you've got extra expenses as well for health and things like that. So just if you are in that position where you're looking to give away money, just think about it in terms of what's happening in January as opposed to where you're at now.
Okay, good. 131873 is the number if you have any questions of your own. Talking about investments, people will be asking, thinking as we speak now, does my super have the right investments? Does it have the right investment mix? How can people tell?
Good question. The first thing to do is, I guess, be aware of what options are available in your fund. So a lot of people just go into the default fund and aren't even aware that there might be 10, 20, 100 different investment options available to them. So generally the way to find out is, I mean, you could go to the website for your super fund and download the product disclosure statement, or they'll often just have a separate booklet called the investment menu, and you'll have a full listing of all the different investment options available, and it should tell you a little bit about them, you know, what they can invest in. There's normally a range of things they can invest in. So for example, a share fund may not always be invested in shares. It may have the ability to hold 20% in cash from time to time if that's what the fund manager thinks is appropriate. So get that list, work out what's available, and then the harder question is what then to choose, because that's often, I guess, what we find in the office. People come in and say, oh, my super fund is going well, or I've heard or seen the TV advertising or radio advertising, and this fund is really good. But that fund is not necessarily very good. It's just one particular investment option within that super fund is good. And you'd only benefit from that if that's the one that you chose after having read all the paraphernalia. So that would be the starting point. And then from there, I guess you need to ask yourself, does that give you sufficient choice? Because there are, I guess, some industry super funds that may only offer half a dozen different choices. And if you've got a large amount of money inside your fund, you might say, well, you know what, I'd like to spread it across a few more areas than just that.
Diversify.
And that's where you need to shop around between funds and maybe find one that offers more choice and one that you're not going to grow out of. Because a simple fund might suit you when you're in your 20s, but by the time you hit your 40s and 50s, you're probably looking for something a little more comprehensive. And it's often better to think about that in advance so that you don't get to your 40s and 50s and then have to go and change all your arrangements and move to a different super fund. The reason for that is there's often very large benefits to sticking with a fund for a good period of time. And that's because you don't want to be buying and selling assets. And your super fund actually pays capital gains tax as well if you sell something. So if you can afford to hang on to it and delay selling it, you delay any of that tax implication.
Okay, good. 131873. It's just about to go 12:30. Any questions, give us a call. We'll take a break, back with more in just a sec. Morning, 131873, talking finance in the first hour, then open line after 1, 131873. Now, with IT Financial Services, you can look forward to a brighter financial future. See, IT Financial Services works with you in partnership to help you achieve your goals and to secure your financial future. Over almost 30 years, their advisors have helped thousands of people, all walks of life, with everything from superannuation and investments to insurances and debt management, and it's never too early to start your financial journey. Just make one call to IT Financial Services on 9258 7500. We'll give that number out again later in the show. Or you can visit their website at itfs.com.au. That's itfs.com.au to get started. IT Financial Services is Australia's own high-quality financial planning company. 9258 7500 is the open line number. Carly Tonkinson and Paul, Philip Tafe joins us this morning from ITFS. You tell us about this thing called Go Aspire, the latest scheme to go under. I mean, how do people spot these sort of things before they get trapped?
Go Aspire has been in the media for years, you know, on and off. So it's been around. Go Aspire is one of these, you know, multi-level marketing type schemes. So look, I would say anything that sounds really attractive, anything that says you can earn income for doing nothing, anything that's offering high guaranteed rates of return, anything that you need to act now so you don't miss out, you know, all of these sort of things, these are the things you should be looking for. They're pretty clever. You know, the marketing in these companies is amazing, but... yeah, I mean, a lot of people, just from this scheme and from others, Australians, I think, lose, you know, we're talking about nearly $1 billion a year to investment scams. There are government sites, ScamWatch and MoneySmart, so both of those will talk a bit about warning signs and also list schemes that you need to be wary of. But I think it's that, you know, if it sounds too good to be true, then it probably is. So you just need to be really cautious. And, you know, everybody thinks it wouldn't happen to them, but, you know, we've seen plenty of clients even come through our door who've fallen victim to some of these schemes. And we've had people try and market these investments to us, but it doesn't take much to dig below the surface and see that, you know, they're really not based on much substance.
Mm. I'm always amazed that, you know, it's not like when you buy a share and you say, look, I'm going to buy $1,000 worth of that, and then you lose it and it's no big deal. When people go into these scams, they seem to be somehow convinced to put every cent that they've got into it. So I would say a very simple rule of thumb is if you think one of these things is worth investing in, you should still have some kind of rule that you'd never put more than 5% of your portfolio in it or something like that, so that if something went wrong, there's the limit to your damage.
Because the key word is always diversify, isn't it? Diversity in your portfolio. But as you say, some people say, well, this just looks great, I'm going to get rich, and they put everything in.
Yeah, they do, because they run the numbers and they're promised an 8% return, and isn't it great? Well, if I get 8% on my $500,000, I can live comfortably forever. It just doesn't work that way. And the other simple way of looking at it is what interest rates will banks pay you now on a bank account? So if you can only get 2 or 3% on a bank account, if anything else is offering you 5 or 6 or 7 or 8, then you just know that it's coming with an equivalent level of risk. So it's a really simple rule of thumb, but it holds true for pretty much any investment that you'll look at. The other thing is... with some of these, you know, scams or bad investments, you know, never respond, I guess, to an unprompted call or email and things like that. Generally, that's the way they target you.
A lot of telemarketing.
It's generally not that you've gone to an advisor and got good advice on where to put your money. It's, I saw some online ad or, you know, I got this email or, I guess, getting in contact in some of these ways where you think, well, that's not really the way I'd be going and looking for an investment.
But I think even just from looking into it, seminars seem to be also a big area of concern. So that's where, you know, and they might have, you know, famous investors speaking or motivational speakers and things like this, and they'll get you in the door, but, you know, they'll sell you a book or they'll sell you a software system. You know, options trading used to be a popular one prior to the GFC. So there's a lot of things like that where it sounds legitimate and you think, I'm going to a seminar, I'm educating myself. But it's the marketing when you get there. So never, ever go to a seminar and sign up on the day.
And often paying for that seminar. You know, they often charge $5,000 just to walk in the door. Mm. So you think it's legitimate.
Only the elite could afford this.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. In fact, it's funny you mention all this. I was watching 7:30 last night and there was a segment there. It wasn't about Bitcoin, but it was about an affiliate type of industry like that, something run out of some bloke out of India that has an office in Adelaide or something. And, you know, there's all these stories of people saying, oh, I put all my $7,000 of savings into these, you know, coins and now I can't get it back. And what on earth is all this Bitcoin and, I mean, you know, people saying, I put my real money into this fake money and now I can't get my real money back and I'm upset. But, I mean, hello,
I mean, Bitcoins, it was like trading as a separate currency. So it's they're like virtual credits, I suppose. That's what they are. So you can use them to buy other goods and services online and you hope that the value of Bitcoins exceeds the value of what you've put in. So, but again, why would you put all your money into one thing like that? It just
seems ridiculous to me.
But
I'm not an expert, but I mean, I wouldn't go near it with a barge pole.
No, but some people get absorbed in it, and I find it incredible. There are some of these virtual worlds where people live and play computer games, and they buy property on these computer games, and the valuations can stretch into the hundreds of thousands of dollars. So, you know, you want the best house on the computer street, that's what people pay. And there's a real market for it. And you know what? While that game's popular, it could actually work out all right because there might be someone who wants to buy that house from you.
There's someone a bit more of a sucker than you.
There's always someone. Yeah.
But then as soon as that game becomes unpopular, and I guess it's like any investment, something's only of that value if you can actually find somebody willing to buy it from you.
Mm.
And that was the same problem that we had, I guess, during, say, a global financial crisis. You know, it was even real properties. They might have, I guess, technically been worth more, but you just couldn't sell them to anyone. And that's why values fell, not that the properties were worthless. It was just that people couldn't get the funds to buy them at I guess, what the going rate.
But of course, at least in a real property, even if it was some sort of bunged up piece of nonsense out the back of Vegas, at least someone could sleep under the roof. You know, the real human could walk in, not just 243,000 pixels on a screen. but you know, people go for this.
Yeah, and it's real money, as you say, and it's a lot of money, and a lot of people do invest everything. So I guess, you've got people out there who probably should be concentrating on buying their first home and they're buying virtual homes
online.
It'd be online.
Very interesting to hear from someone who does this, you know, what motivates them and I guess what tempted them to do it in the first place and how do they afford to do it, I guess, if you're spending most of your life on this world, how are you?
In the old days, you know, I suppose you can't drive a model train, can you? But a lot of people spent heaps of money buying the best Hornby train that money could buy, and they had it and no one else did. And, well, okay, you could touch it, but, I mean, these days it's all online. It's a similar principle. But
I guess it is. I mean, I guess hobby trains, and there would have been collector's items with those, I imagine.
And people that buy stamps, you know, really expensive stamps. What, you can't use it again. It's an investment, but it's only worth if someone even more keen on stamps is willing to buy it from you for more.
I think my grandma did that for me for years and years, always collected stamps and coins.
Throw them out.
Well, I actually took them along to someone in the city who, you know, cast their eye over it, and I think the whole collection was worth about $50 because of one stamp that had some kind of value. the other hundreds were worthless, and
it was very
disappointing.
Yes. You can hand down that investment to the next generation. 131-873 is the number. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning. Yes, hello to everybody there. I just wanted to find out for superannuation which ones we should go for, or how would you find the best one to go for? I'm with some people that have been with for the last 7 years, but just not seeing any, well, if it's working for me, that's all.
Yeah, there's a few different ways you can go about it, Mark. You can either research yourself, and I know the Herald... it used to be on Wednesdays, we'd actually publish a list of different super funds and performances. So you could start your research there. And obviously online, look amongst the funds and see what investments they have to offer. You could also look at the fund you're in and just make sure that your investment choice within that fund is okay. So potentially the fund has some good investments, but you're just not invested in them. Or alternatively, go and see a financial advisor and get them to go through, you know, what you're looking for and offer you some advice on what options you have available to you.
Right, okay. Because I'd sort of get on the internet and just put in top 10 super funds. And one that I'm in doesn't usually come in that top 10.
Yeah, but this is where, as Philip was saying earlier, you just need to be a little bit careful with those ratings, because what they're doing is comparing a particular investment option within the fund. You know, there may be other investment options that have performed well. Often they might just look at the default investment option within each fund and rate those. So you do need to research a little bit deeper to get an accurate picture yourself, because often what you're comparing there isn't relevant to your situation.
Yeah, you generally find that the top 10 from last year will not be the top 10 for the following year, and that's the risk of, I guess, chasing last year's best performers. And if you did a search similar to that before the global financial crisis, a lot of the funds that did the best were the ones that basically collapsed during the GFC. So I definitely wouldn't encourage you to choose the fund on that basis.
Okay, so like a company like yourself, if I come and see new people, you could check that out for me and see if I'm going the right way down the line.
Absolutely, Mark. So that's one of the ways that we help people, is to go through the current fund, go through their options, and just make recommendations on investment options within the funds and other structures as well, based on your own situation.
We'll end up looking at it from a number of different angles too. You know, what fees are you paying on that fund versus the alternatives? Your insurance options, you know, are you getting those as cheaply and cost effectively as possible? And then also based on, I guess, the choice of investment and, you know, where you're heading, I guess, and what you really are going to need over the next 10 or 20 years.
Yeah, so that's what sort of worries me, because going to a financial advisor, if you're picking a good one out of the phone book, so to speak, and if they're not sort of just going to push you into ones that they like.
Look, a good place to start there, Mark, you know, maybe have a chat to some friends and see if they're already seeing somebody that they're happy with. Often that can be a good way to find someone. Any financial advisor should, you know, be offering you a free initial consultation anyway, so it gives you a chance to sit down and have a decent chat with them and work out whether or not they're going to be the people for you without having to commit any money or too much of your time. So I agree, go and see a few people. Don't just, you know, go with the first planner you see.
And also look at their qualifications. You know, you can become a financial planner with, you know, not too much effort. But if you choose somebody that's got a qualification like CFP, which stands for Certified Financial Planner, you know that person has been through the ringer in terms of training and, you know, many years' worth of effort just to get that qualification.
Okay, then. All right, thank you. I'll make sure I listen for your phone number when I finish. I might give you a yell and take it from there.
Great, Mark.
Well done, Mark. Thank you for calling. 131-873. We'll give that phone number out again shortly. I've just been watching, as you guys were speaking there to Mark, David Cameron up on CNN and Sky Live answering questions in the British House of Reps about, well, certainly his father's overseas investment funds. And the quote running along the ticker there is David Cameron saying, "Overseas funds don't necessarily lead to tax avoidance." No, but why would you have one otherwise?
I think certainly those where you are, the structure of the company or the trust is located somewhere offshore. I can't think of another reason to do that other than the tax structure.
So tax minimisation.
Minimisation is a good word. Yeah. So, yeah, that's been an interesting one. And I mean, it was such a small amount, I guess, that he's declaring anyway. What did he say? He made $40,000 capital gain from this trust himself.
Because we also haven't had a prime minister, I believe, that has had overseas tax, investment funds, but in a different part of the Americas.
Well, yeah, interesting. We haven't seen his name come forward, but I guess, yeah, he's got some different locations there.
But you might actually find, if you delved into all our finances, we have some kind of link to these things without even being aware of it.
Is that because of our super funds?
Possibly. Because I recall, again, pre-financial crisis, there were a lot of these hedge funds, and yeah, they were all domiciled in the Cayman Islands or something like that. And at the time, I guess it was promoted as one of their benefits. That's why you pay them extra, because they do all these things. But as it turns out, that's often for shady reasons.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just trying to think. I mean, you're the expert, so I'm not, but I'm just trying to think why anyone would want... Well, why there would be another reason other than to minimise your tax exposure in a higher tax jurisdiction like Australia to have your investment funds in some sort of tropical island somewhere.
Well, also to shelter the fact that you own it. So I guess to hide assets and also to potentially launder assets, which is something, well, one of the major issues that's coming out of these Panama Papers. I can't think of a highly... altruistic reason?
Well, sometimes less regulation, because, you know, if you operate out of a certain region, you're not governed by the same rules. You can go and buy and sell things more easily without having to do all the same paperwork and tick all the same boxes and red tape. So for an investment company, I assume that would be a huge attraction, just to be able to get on with things without having Big Brother watching. The counter argument is, but we have Big Brother watching here to protect us from, you know, I guess, more shady activities. So that's why it's almost worth having some red tape to...
So is the question, well, is the position maybe not that these Latin American jurisdictions and British former empirical territories and the like have unfortunate or advantageous tax arrangements, but that jurisdictions like Australia should catch up and get the same? Should we become more like them? That's the question.
Well, in a way, you do have that argument, and that's the argument for dropping the company tax rate, for example, is to make us more competitive. It's, you know, certainly, you know, if we went down that path of having state taxes, you would find the states really competing on their state tax levels the same way they do in America. Mm. Different states have lower taxes, so you find a lot of companies have their headquarters there. Same theory is, you know, you hope that lower tax rates will attract more investment.
So Tasmania dropped their rate to 22 cents on the dollar, and what, all of a sudden the BHP set up in Launceston, do they?
Oh, they'd love that.
Yeah, maybe. All right, 131873. Tom, good morning.
Hey, how you going, guys?
Good, thank you.
I've just got a question. My wife inherited some shares about 2.5 years ago from my father, who passed away. And basically, over the past 3 years, the shares have nearly halved in value, and it was quite a large amount worth. I was just wondering if you could get some advice whether we should offload them now.
Is it a number of different shares in the portfolio, Tom?
No, it was just one company shares that her father worked for many years, and he accrued the shares, and in his will, they were shared between... her and her sisters.
Okay, if it's a specific company, the best thing to do is...
Can I name the company?
Probably not best to, Tom.
Probably best to call us. We wouldn't have the research in front of us at the moment anyway, Tom, but when we give out the number, call the office tomorrow and we'll be able to send you out some research on the company just so that you can have a bit of a look about what, you know, a number of different brokers are saying about the company, and that will just, you know, give you a starting point. And certainly we can talk in more detail...
Yeah,
you know, about our thoughts
how much
on that too.
Money's been lost already, and it's continuing to go south. So
it's not all. I mean, it's hard to know. I mean, certainly there is a case where, you know, you want to get out while you can with as much as you can, but sometimes it's just a matter of, you know, global economy or just the market in general as to why the shares are valued at where they're at.
Yep.
So the important thing to do is to look at company research and just find out, you know, the reason for the decline in value and the outlook going forward. But and again, I mean, seems to be the theme for tonight, diversification. So holding, you know, a substantial amount of money in one company, no matter how good that company seems to be, you're always taking on that risk.
Okay.
All right, okay. So give us a call at the office, Tom, and we'll get some more information out to you.
Great, thanks for your time.
Thanks,
okay,
Tom.
Okay, Tom, good question. Yeah, a lot of people. I mean, it's the cut and run question, isn't it? When do you cut your losses? It's like a gambler. When do you say I've lost enough?
And if it's only going down simply because the share market is down, you know, the market's down 10 or 20% now, and if your shares are down roughly in line with that, you think, okay, fair enough.
Ballpark. But
it, like Tom, if the share's gone down 50% and the market's only down 10 or 20, you'd then be saying, well, hang on. Is there a much bigger problem here? So that's where nobody wants to sell at a loss. But you also, if the writing's on the wall for that company and it's actually not going to survive, you do want to get out while you can.
Yeah, you don't want to be riding the horse called underperformer, do you, for too long? No. Actually, talking about horses, well done, Kaylee, on the information throughout the week on self-managed super funds and punting on racehorses.
Yeah, I haven't gone out and bought one, so no. That's good. That was the first step.
Yes, nor have I. It's, by the way, I don't have a self-managed super fund. It's 10 to 1, back in a sec. 1131873, any personal finance questions for the team from IT Financial Services? Get in now, not long left. We're doing open line after 1 o'clock. 1131873 is the number. Carly and Phil are here to answer your questions. Just to explain the little quip before the break there regarding self-managed super funds and racehorses. Last week we had a hypothetical, didn't we, Carly, about whether somebody... in all the different exotic investments you might want to put in your SMSF, be it an artwork or something like that, what about a racehorse? And sort of a question without notice.
Yes, and sadly we didn't know the answer. So, looking into that during the week, it seems to be technically you could do it, but people just don't. The distinction is, racehorses for investment purposes tend to be, these larger syndicates and they're run like a business. You are not allowed to run a business through self-managed super. So that type of scale would not be allowed. If you just have, your one or two racehorses hobby type racing, technically you may be able to have it in super, but there would be no point given that you're on a zero tax rate on hobby horses yourself, whereas your super fund would be paying tax at 15%. So it would actually just end up costing you more money than otherwise it would. Apparently it's just not seen.
But I guess a lot of people, they don't worry about the tax with things. They think, but I just want a horse. And if I can't afford it myself, super fund could be a way of doing it. We could start this up. Oh. We could specialise in
how about you
horses
start it
in
up
super.
And let me know how it goes.
Yes, I'd love to see some of those race callers get their tongue around SMSF coming down the home straight. Yes. Now, talking about the Sydney Morning Herald, as you did earlier, there's a story today, which I think you guys have in front of you as well, in the Herald today saying too poor to retire, more Australians than ever will work past 70. It says more than ever will intend to work beyond 70 years old as Generation X's and baby boomers, which I suppose are their parents, fear they lack the financial security needed to retire any sooner. Is there anything they can do about this? I mean, the people saying, look, Paul, Phil and Carly, I don't want to work to 70. You're the financial people. Help me.
Well, there's lots of options available to people. I mean, people could cut back on work hours. This age 70 thing became quite topical when they've looked at moving the age pension age. I think there's certainly a lot of jobs where you could comfortably work till 70, but I also think there's a lot of jobs where you couldn't, a lot of physical jobs where it's a bit rough to ask somebody. Unfortunately, a lot of those jobs can also be low-income jobs, so potentially, because superannuation is percentage-based, you haven't built up a big super balance, and then you're stuck with a situation where you can't afford to retire. I think another problem is, and again, particularly in Sydney, we're having to put so much of our resources into our house, and that, of course, takes money away from adding into your super. So I think that problem, certainly for Generation X, and I think it will continue beyond that as well, will become an issue. So where we've seen certainly some of the earlier baby boomers benefit from that housing market, and in a lot of cases paying for retirement, I think later generations will find it tough to balance that house in Sydney and a reasonable balance in super and retire at a reasonable age.
And that's where a lot of people's retirement plan involves the downsize of their home. So, yes, the house is expensive. It's cost me a lot. But you know what? It's worth millions of dollars. And when I retire, I'm going to go live in that smaller apartment and cash in on the home. And the way the tax system works, that's actually quite cost effective to do because there's no capital gains tax.
So you on the family home.
That's right. Mm. So you can sell it and be left with a good lump of money outside the system. But I do think the days are gone where, you know, years gone by, you hit 60, they gave you your gold Rolex and said, see you later.
In what business did that happen? Be waiting for that.
But whereas these days, I think it's actually can be a good thing where I guess older people are encouraged to continue working part-time and they often want to. So if there's demand for it, that's good, so long as you can get the work-life balance right.
Well, as the article here says, seniors groups say that the figures indicate people are ageing in a much healthier way and want to keep working, but also reveal deep financial uncertainty among older workers following a series of superannuation and pension changes.
Mm.
It's probably more the latter, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. And I mean, you said, what can you do about it?
Mm.
I mean, there aren't that many things other than, okay, if you don't have enough, you need to reevaluate your budget. You know, maybe you need to spend less and then you can retire earlier. Or what a lot of people have the attitude of is, I'm just going to live well now. And when I hit 80, you know what? I don't care anymore. I'll go back to living on the age pension because at that point I'll have had a good life and I'll be willing to live more simply. So I guess it's not what we'd encourage people to base their retirement planning on, but that's a lot of people's attitude.
But it is one thing to have that attitude now, although I think if you asked a lot of people who held that belief when they were 60 but are now 80 and living off the age pension, they might say, I wish I was a little more frugal 25 years ago.
100% right, yeah. That's of course right. The other thing I would say, I mean, people do worry about the market. You know, we had the GFC, we've got the current market now. A poor investment market should never, ever throw off your retirement plans or really even change them because we're always going to have downturns in the market. And if you've got your investments structured in the right way, it doesn't matter what the market's doing in the short to medium term. Your plan should account for that. So even people looking now at retiring, if you've got the right plan in place, it shouldn't be a factor. And it would be, unless you've structured things in the wrong way or unless you've taken out a lot more money than what you'd anticipated, investment performance will rarely throw a financial plan off track.
Well, to both of you this morning, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You
covered a fair bit of ground. Mm. And look forward to doing it again next week. Have a good week.
Thank you. You too.
We'll be back in a sec.